Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, let's not talk about politics this week.
No, there's a lot of politics going on.
No, let's just get in the holiday spirit. Let's just sort of lay back.
Drink heavily.
Kick back.
Kick back. That's what we need in Washington, more kickbacks. But a lot of people are not so happy with their president, and I do mean the Democratic Party.
Well, you know, the Democratic Party suddenly woke up this week and said, whoa, the president just made a compromise deal with the Republicans about taxes and a bunch of other issues. How come he did that? As though they had no idea that there was going to be a train wreck on January 1st and taxes were going to go up on everybody in the whole country unless some kind of a deal was made. And you know, Ken, nobody seems to have ever heard of the United States Senate.
Well, certainly, you know, one group of people who have not heard of the United States Senate are the members of the United States Senate. Where were they all these months? Why do you wait until after an election or a lame duck session when they only have a little bit time left when they have a big 57-58?
This isn't leaving things to the end. This is pushing things to the end.
Well,
this is not a question of people having managed their time poorly. This is a question of one party having managed their time perfectly. The Republicans challenged the Democrats to have a vote on tax cuts before the election. They said, okay, you think your position is more popular than ours?
Right.
Our position is give a tax cut to everybody, no matter how rich they are. The last 2% of the population, the last 1% of the population, the last 0.25% of the population, give them all tax cuts.
I don't think that's what the words were. That's
no, of course not, but that was
the
their
Ron
position.
Elving interpretation.
But that was their position, tax cuts for
yes,
all.
Yes, for all.
So they pushed the whole process past the election. They win the election. Then they look at the Democrats and say, okay, now what's your position on tax cuts? The Democrats say only for income under $250,000 right. because the people who have income higher get the same tax cut on the first $250,000. Right. So they say, let's have a vote. The Democrats prevail in the House with their tax cuts up to $250,000. But in the Senate, how many senators took the position that tax cuts should not be cut off at $250,000 in
30,
income?
30-something.
36.
Yeah.
36. And those 36 people, those 36 are writing the policy for a 100-member Senate and overturning the policy of the 435-member House and trumping the president.
Is it just coming to you right now that the minority rules in the Senate as opposed to the House? I mean, this is basically what happens to the Senate rules.
To me or to the American people? In other words, how many people know when the president goes out and says, here's the deal I worked out with Republicans, that there was even a vote the previous Saturday? Or how many people know why 36 votes rules in the Senate if there are only 53 in the majority and they don't reach 60? How many people know that?
Yes, but we've seen that both sides play the game. My point is that you need 60 to get anything accomplished in the Senate, whether it's a...
Because
of the filibuster rule.
Uh-huh. Yes. Okay. But nobody ever talks about this. I think if you ask the average American how many filibusters there were in this past Congress or in this past year, they would say...
None.
Zero.
Well, yeah, because nobody stood up. Jimmy Stewart didn't stand up for 12 hours or 24 hours.
Exactly.
Strom Thurmond didn't stand up in filibuster civil rights.
That's right. What a filibuster is exactly. In the popular imagination. It's what they see in the movies.
We need more filibusters of civil rights rules. Where is Strom Thurmond now when we need him?
But where is the awareness of how the Senate operates, which is you don't need to stand up for 12 hours anymore. All you have to say is, I'm going to filibuster.
Look, you can talk about the inequity, and I agree with you about this, that 36 senators can decide tax policy in this country, but at the same time...
Any policy.
Well, any policy, right.
All
right,
policy.
Right. But who won the argument? What side won the argument whether it should be tax cuts for all or none? I mean, I still...
When was that argument held?
Well, I would argue that it was held on November 2nd.
How many people who voted on November 2nd thought they were voting for higher taxes or lower taxes on millionaires?
Why didn't the Democratic Party make the case that the Republican Party stands for tax cuts for the
rich? Now I think we're asking a question we both think is a hard question to answer. I don't know why the Democrats were afraid to campaign on this. The polls all show that by hefty majorities, people think that it's okay to cut off the tax cuts for all, but only up to a certain income. And people seem to be okay with that 250 level, certainly okay with $500,000 a year or $1 million a year.
Even in that Senate vote you were talking about, so Charles Schumer said, okay, $250,000 is not acceptable, let's do it to $1 million. We'll make the case that income beyond $1 million should be taxed. That
no difference.
Failed as well.
No difference.
Yeah.
So despite the fact that the polls all show that that's a popular position, the Democrats were not willing to really bring it out and really bank on that. Why?
I don't know. I don't know why.
Is it because they assume that if the Republicans dig their heels in and the tax increase in results on everyone on January 1st when the Bush tax cuts run out?
Democrats get blamed for it.
Exactly.
Well, that's basically what
Why is that true?
Well, that's why President Obama said at his news conference this week, he said, look, I tried as much as I can and I couldn't move anymore. I couldn't move them at all. And I got as much as I can get. Here's another question. Why couldn't the Democratic Party say, look, you have these 2 million people. Their unemployment insurance is not extended. They're out of money. They can't buy Christmas gifts. They can't pump money into the economy. The Republican Party is heartless.
There did not seem to be much effort made to embarrass the Republicans for their position or to highlight what the Republicans' position was. The only way it could get done would be one of two ways. Let the taxes go up on January 1, let the jobless benefits be cut off, let all the pain be inflicted, and then try to point back 2-3 weeks and go, oh, it was the Republicans who did it. That's not going to work.
No.
We know that's not going to work. The only other way I can see to get this conversation started would be to have the president come out and say, well, we had this vote in the Senate, it failed, we prevailed in the House, we only had 53 votes in the Senate, not enough, so I have to compromise with the Republicans, here's the compromise, and then suddenly everybody's paying attention.
Right.
Everybody's screaming and yelling about it. Maybe this is a teachable moment.
Well, but who learns the lesson here? Perhaps the Democrats who failed to have the profiles and courage to have the vote earlier. Maybe they realized the errors of their ways. But it's going to be a little late now because they did have 59-60 Senate votes, nominally 60 votes.
Only nominally,
right, exactly.
Only temporary.
But certainly much more than the 53 they're going to have in the 112th Congress. And so you think that they could have done much more, certainly a sizable amount of accomplishments than they will next year. First of all, there's so many reactions to what Obama did. A lot of people say we want compromise. We want people who reach across party lines. We don't want, you know, the line in the sand stuff. We want give and take. Well, Obama stood up there at the news conference saying that here's what I've done, and the progressive wing of the Democratic Party went ballistic.
And also the most conservative wing of the Republican Party.
Somewhat so.
Well,
yeah.
No. Jim DeMint came out and said, I'm against this. Sarah Palin came out and said, I'm against this. A lot of Republicans have either said they're going to vote against it or said they're reserving judgment.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying there are a bunch of Republicans who said that, you know, increasing the debt by $900 billion is kind of like hypocritical, saying that we can't extend unemployment benefits because it's not paid for, and yet we're going to have $900 billion tax breaks for everyone.
Oh, no, wait a minute. The Republicans will tell you that tax cuts do not have to be paid for because they eventually stimulate the economy and lead to more tax revenue. They will point to some of the Reagan years, and they will point to the early 1960s when a JFK tax cut seems to have stimulated revenue for the federal government. There are episodes in history when that has been true. There are episodes in history where tax increases, such as those of 1990 and 1993, were followed by tremendous decades of growth. So it's just possible that the marginal tax rates of the federal government aren't the most important thing that determine which direction the economy goes in.
Well, all I know is that it just seems like there are more happy Republicans this week than there are happy Democrats. And, of course, one of the typically lame responses is, well, we must have this. That means President Obama needs to be challenged in the 2012 primaries. And, you know, everybody from Bob Kuttner to Rabbi Michael Lerner.
Which would be the full gamut from A to B.
Well, the left.
Robert Kuttner and Michael Lerner, pretty much.
They're on the left, but I think there is a growing despondency among the left wing of the Democratic Party.
And if there's one thing you need to guarantee that despondency is well placed, it's a challenge to Barack Obama from the left.
No, but the same thing we saw with Nixon in 72 when the fact that he had the John Ashbrook, because he had the temerity to go to China. John Schmitz, the congressman from California at the time, says, I don't mind Nixon going to China, I just mind that he came back. I mean, the right wing was really, really upset. And Pat Buchanan at the time was...
You're saying that helped Richard Nixon win 49 states in 1972. I think it did.
No, what I'm saying...
Although it didn't help him as much as the Democrats helped him by nominating George McGovern.
I would say George McGovern probably helped more than John Ashbrook. But I think the point is that there's always a group on the Republicans' right and the Democrats' left that are just really so unhappy about the lack of ideological purity that they will talk about some challenge. Now, what I'm saying for 2012 is that it could be something very symbolic or something ridiculous like a Dennis Kucinich who's not going to make a difference. Or if the anger is so deep and so real, then now we're talking about the Howard Deans or the Russ Feingolds of the world.
Yeah, I think Russ Feingold might be a prospect in the sense that he's a highly unpredictable fellow. He was out there voting against the Democratic version of the tax cut extension on that Saturday we've spoken of. I don't think Howard Dean would be the person who would be successful in this particular role. And I'm not really sure that Russ Feingold wouldn't prefer to do something more fruitful with the rest of his life. But it's possible that somebody will see. I mean, Dennis Kucinich is a pretty good prospect because he loves being a presidential candidate. It's the only time anybody pays attention to him outside of Cleveland. And, you know, he might do it. What kind of prospects do you think he would have, Ken?
He probably would have none. I mean, right now, I think that it's just a pipe dream for the left to talk about this great challenge. But the anger and the disappointment is real. But here's another thing. What if you can make the argument that the economy improves by 2012? Can you say that it was the tax cut deal that did it? And if the economy doesn't improve, then, I mean, in other words, I almost think that Republicans are almost in a no-lose situation going into 2012 on this.
Yes, they're in a no-lose situation in a number of ways, except that they need to choose a candidate, and that candidate will expose them some sort of a vulnerability. And the other thing is they need to maintain this unity, and that unity has depended largely on being in the minority and being desperate. Can you hold together a larger number of Republicans as effectively as Mitch McConnell was able to hold together 42 Republicans for the purposes of this lame duck session? And by the way, as a result of that unified 42, they're also going to be able to kill the DREAM Act, which was an opportunity for children of immigrants who are in this country illegally to either go to college or serve in the military. These are people who did not come here
and get legal status.
That's right. They were brought here by their parents. And they also are going to be able, it appears, to kill the defense authorization bill for the first time in more than a generation over the issue of don't ask, don't tell.
Well, the perfect example is Newt Gingrich. In pre-1994 and post-1994, when Newt Gingrich was the minority whip for the Republicans prior to 1994, I mean, he really tossed the bombs, kept the party united. But once 1994 came and they became the majority party,
things
in
got
Congress,
tougher.
Sure, it's much tougher. Now,
I wonder if it gets tougher even before. Well, of course, they are the majority now in the House.
And they won't be the majority in the Senate. Mitch McConnell will still be the minority leader in the Senate, but there will be a considerably larger number.
47.
Right. But, you know, going back to the point you made just before about whether Republicans could keep that unity and who they come up with in 2012, I mean, that's the old Harry Reid argument. We've been saying for years, Harry Reid is unpopular, you know, in big trouble, unlikely to win re-election against generic Republicans. But once they come up with a Republican, in this case it was Sharon Angle.
An extra generic Republican.
And Harry Reid won re-election. So you think of, oh, that Obama's so dead in the water for 2012. What if the Republican Party, with this new power, with this new sense of power, just tears itself apart going into the 2012 primaries?
Well, one sort of laboratory for testing that is the upcoming vote for a new chairman of the Republican National Committee. That, of course, has been Michael Steele for the last 2 years. He has presided over the Republican Party at a time of great advance for them in terms of election success. But despite the fact
that he
did not raise very much money for them in that process, most of the money was raised by other Republican organizations, and he generated a fair amount of controversy, both with the things that he said and with the handling of money by the Republican National Committee while he was there, so that he has, among those running now for his job, Gentry Collins, who has come out against him and is opposing him.
Was the political director of the RNC, right?
That's right. And also Reince Priebus from Wisconsin, who was the chairman of the Wisconsin State Republican Party, had a fantastic year, best year for Republicans in Wisconsin, in my memory.
In case people don't forget, they beat Russ Feingold with Ron Johnson. They won the governorship with Scott Walker, and they won two House seats.
That's right.
They beat Steve Kagan, and they won Dave Obey's congressional seat that
he retired.
Right. Since 1969.
That's right. So it was the best year for Republicans in Wisconsin in probably living memory. It was a fantastic success, and I think Reince has gotten a lot of the credit for it. Reince Priebus, the chairman there, who had also been highly instrumental in supporting Michael Steele as the national chairman 2 years ago. So for Steele to have lost him indicates a real deterioration of his position. I can't see how Steele can even stand for re-election.
No, I agree with you. I don't think he runs. Until this week, we had two unresolved races that have now been resolved. New York won. Tim Bishop was declared the winner by 543 votes, having won by 45,000 2 years ago.
And that would be less this time.
Considerably less. And in Minnesota governor's race, Tom Emmer has conceded to Mark Dayton. So we do have a resolving with Minnesota governor and New York won, and we may be days away from finally resolving the Alaska Senate race. A state judge this week decided that he will hear Joe Miller's argument that you have to throw out all these
every ballot for Lisa Murkowski, whether it's spelled correctly or not.
Anything that's not for Joe Miller, throw it out.
Because, well, that was printed on the ballot, and these other names were written, and that can't be official.
It's easy to spell, Miller. So anyway, we think that finally everything will be resolved.
Now we are closing the book on the November 2010 elections.
Before we end the podcast, I just want to add a farewell to Elizabeth Edwards. There's something about watching not only somebody lose a child, which is just beyond comprehension, to suffer a public battle with cancer, and to have an unfaithful husband, and have all three happen to you in the public purview is just more stress and more horror than I can imagine one human being. And yet, by almost every account, she was unfailingly optimistic. She believed in the future, and she had a great disposition and things like that. There was a lot of carping about her. We saw that in the Game Change book, saying that she was, you know, churlish and rude and things like this. But God knows that she was in this horrific position for many years, and her private battles became public, and it was just a very sad way to end that life.
A salute then to Elizabeth Edwards. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.